Blog Talk Radio.
Today on top of fucking news, 11 mass shootings, I believe it said, this morning that I read. So, we got a few topics today, including one with parenting with a narcissist. Co-parent, who doesn't co-parent? Anyone familiar with the term? I'm sure if you've followed the show, you've probably caught up with the section in the psychological areas where we were going into narcissist personality dating and all that stuff. Well, along with narcissist boyfriends come fucking babies. Sometimes, if you're not smart, plan B's everywhere now, guys. Eat that shit like candy. Actually, you just have to eat it once a month. When you're fucking dropping an egg, eat a plan B. I can't take birth control, so it makes me crazy. I would like to not want to kill my family. I already have estrogen and what is it called? Testosterone, because I am intersex. I am both male and female. I possess two urethras, which is why. Oh yeah, girls, if you're a squirter, check it out. You were probably going to be a boy. But that's for another day. But I mean, this is pussy talk and girl talk. We missed yesterday because, you know what, my narcissist co-parent does not co-parent, and he thinks he knows more than the school, and no, he doesn't. He's not a teacher. He's not certified. He needs to stop torturing my daughter. The world is sad, you guys. It's as if the laws now protect neglecting males who are terrible fathers who don't pay child support, and nasty, horrible men who commit mass murder and also, you know, kill innocent people and domestic violence perpetrators. People who defy orders of restraint, like seriously. There is a lot of work to be done. So, you know, I feel oftentimes now that we really can't pretend that we can rely on the system to be intact when we need it, because I'm sorry, but there is no reason why someone who does not pay, does not participate, does not stick to the fabric, does not follow the program that they even tried to set and is doing more harm than good, that they should be even having any rights. So I don't know what is wrong with this country. I'm not standing down. I'm my daughter's superhero. And if you can't be on the same team as my daughter, then you need to get the fuck out of the way so she can fucking spread her goddamn wings, bitch, because you in her motherfucking way. That's for goddamn sure. Anyhow, don't give up. Stand tall. You ain't got nothing to worry about. You ain't got nothing to worry about, because, bitch, I ain't got nothing to worry about. I work. I pay my bills, I pay my taxes. I fucking spoil my child. I take care of her needs. Her dad definitely does not. Her father definitely does not do anything for her, and that's hands down. Like, I wish you did. It's really fucking sad. Like, if you can't be on the same team as me, you're not her friend. You're her enemy. She's a person. Don't let your kids go back to a man that hurts them. Don't go back to the man that hurts you either, because you're teaching your child to accept this kind of love. And I refuse to allow that to happen, because that's not okay. I don't want my daughter getting someone like her father who will spit in your fucking face, do terrible shit, and then blame you for it, and then not be responsible. I'm sorry? No. You can kindly take several motherfucking seats, you pussy-ass bitch. So anyway, enough about my feelings. I'm feeling some type of way about some shit. So literally, if you're your child's advocate, stay that. Keep that energy, as he would say. Don't let people get in your way, and don't be afraid to stand in the way of danger, because I have nothing to lose. Nothing. Not a motherfucking thing do I have to motherfucking lose in this goddamn world, because my kid is standing behind me. So, keep that energy, ladies, gentlemen. It is time that we dismantle the systems designed to perpetuate inequality, rape culture, systemic racial injustice, and absolute apathy for those who cannot truly help themselves all the time. At some point, you must take responsibility, of course. You must try and take initiative, of course. Things are a choice. When you talk about mental illness, you know, honestly, for some people, that's not a choice. But it is a choice to keep on trucking. Will I say that I'm mentally ill? I have been before. Who's not? But who has time for that? I absolutely have no time to be sad, depressed. I'm an angry mixed woman. So I have a child who is breaking through barriers, who is incredible and amazing, smart, intuitive, and is just learning to be loving. Who deserves that? And it's only fair that she gets it. And that she accepts nothing less. I won't accept nothing less for her. I'm sorry, that's not going to happen. If you cannot do what you are supposed to motherfucking do, stay the fuck out your child's way. Stop fucking shit up. If you're that parent out there that can't get your shit together, that can't bring it together, that can't make it about your kid, get the fuck out the other parent's way. You're holding up the line. Get the fuck on, post your pick and go. Get the fuck out. That's how I feel about that shit. It's not fair to those of us who pay the motherfucking bills, who are up with the fevers, who are there homeschooling, who have to work 3 or 4 jobs and never hardly get to spend actual time with their child, and bust their ass to put fucking Pampers on them. Fucking get the fuck out the way. Step aside and let the adults handle the motherfucking kids. And please get a vasectomy, because you're useless. You don't need no more. birth control and all this shit falls on women, and then you want to restrict our options. But then when we have this motherfucking shit like what I got going on, you still restrict the options. So stop taking power from parents that are the motherfucking parents and start doing your motherfucking job and enforcing either the other one who's the piece of shit to either step the fuck aside or play the fucking game. You cannot do both. You can't tell me, well, blah, blah, no, fuck, no. Step the fuck out of the way, system, or do better. Because y'all are sad. This is why kids get killed by the other parent that's actually the fucked up one. Because y'all let this shit happen. Do you know what a parent will do to the other one if they catch the other parent after they've harmed the child and they don't make it back home? Can you imagine the official, what would happen to that person that ignored that phone call? Do you know what would happen when an angry mob that follows people who actually get angry start doing? They start getting real angry. The media can be a pro or a con. And at this point, that's all you're giving us is media outlets. That's it. You're not giving us actual tools. You're taking fucking shit even from the police. They can't do much either. We're in the age of Aquarius, and yet we just begin, and so there will be much work to be done, and this is not going to be kind. This is not going to be pretty job. This is going to be some of the most disgusting, horrible scraping off the underbelly of that is the world of humans. It's going to take a lot of ripping off the layers of this bullshit and sucking out all the poison. And it's going to take time, lots of suffering, and lots of people like me. But see, I can't go out in the street and risk my life and go protest. So I thank everybody else who does. I got a radio show. This is what I do. So, you know, keep that energy, ladies and gentlemen. Keep those voices loud and proud and angry. Stay angry. Right now, we've got a lot of shit going on from the constant abuse and death, Black Americans. Asian, both Asian American and immigrants of all origins. Women and children, kids in cages. Need I say more? Tornadoes ripping through 5 states or so. But, you know, we have a president who's actually going to send out FEMA. So at least I can sort of feel a little bit of comfort. But, you know, we had that derecho over there in the upper Midwest, and Trump sent no one. We had all these disasters that happened during Trump that still have not been taken care of. So there's a lot of cleanup and catching up to do, I'm sure, with this administration. Republicans got nothing to offer, so they're giving out photos of Biden falling. But guess what? He went back to work, and he had to be told, and I quote, "You need to dumb down your words and tone it down because the education of the Americans are so low, they can't understand what you're saying, sir." So, you know, Trump was more on the level of the basic American because, you know, they're uneducated and racist. With ignorance, there is more room for misinformation and anger and racism, if you will. The more you learn, and when you go off to a university, you actually learn to be an atheist, and you learn to be more of a liberal, because once you learn about government and what really happens, you will really, really change your views on a lot of things. So if you want to learn about the real world and how your government works and religion and everything else, go to a university, or just pick up the literature that they use. It's incredible. So most people that go to college are actually smarter and use big words. And Biden's more collegiate. So if you don't have a college-based level of comprehension, yeah, Biden's not for you. I mean, he is for you, but he's not for you in course of the way you understand, because you don't understand. So that's probably why you vote Republican. You know, it's I'm a little bit of everything, but I'm conservative in some areas. I'm Republican in some areas. I'm liberal in some areas. I'm Democratic in some areas. But the way I'm Republican is, I like to, and conservative, let's be smart with where we put our investments and what we conserve, environment, water, stuff like that. You need that to live. You can't eat oil. So, you know, stuff like that. I would be more liberal in some areas, like you're a person. Trans rights are rights. Black rights are rights. Asian rights are rights. Child rights are rights. You shouldn't marry children. Republicans are okay with you marrying children. What the fuck is wrong with you people? You know, we've got a lot of things that people don't understand because they're ignorant. And that is not their fault. It's because they're not educated properly by, well, the people who control everything. It's all on purpose. It's so you don't know the difference, and you don't have the cognitive dissonance to understand probably what I just said. Those who don't will vote for someone like Trump because they can understand what he says. They can relate to him because he's stupid like them and racist like them. They hate the same people, but they don't have any idea on policies or how things work. When you talk about our immigration problem, this is the time where they cross the most because it's safer for them. And again, we're not telling them to come here. In fact, he told them to stop. He closed our borders. So, you know, this AR-15 shit, I'm sorry, we don't really need people having easy access to those. And when you've got 30 rounds or so shooting per second, I'm sorry, you don't need that. I'm all about having guns, but I'm all about comprehensive gun control to where I can go to them. My mom wants to keep carrying a gun everywhere she goes now. She's in her 60s. We live in a small town, but guess what? We got crazy people here. So it's like my mom wants to come home from the store alive. And if she's going to die, she's going to die shooting. She's going to shoot the person. Trust me, she'll kill him. She'll kill him. Hands down, she will pull out her gun and she will shoot that person. They might not even make it, you know, to pull off a shot if my mom's there. So, I mean, I trust my mom with a gun for sure. But the fact that she's talking about this is my mom, who's like the most nonviolent person that I know, the most kindest person to humans and animals that I know. And she needs a gun. It's sad. Honestly, after this next year, well, I'm going to be petitioning for my shit back because what Trump did to me was awful. I didn't deserve that at all. That man has totally disrupted my family personally and a lot of other families in so many levels, and mine on every level possible that he fucking could, all the way to trans rights, because being trans, like for me, I have a immunocompromised immune system, basically. I have lupus, so I can't do things like hormones and stuff like that. I can't change my sex and stuff like that. So for me, I'm still going to look like basically what I look like until I start getting more body hair like a male, I guess. I mean, I'm Spanish and also hairy like a Sasquatch, but it's because I have, like, and I look like a dude sometimes. So, I mean, I embrace it. But I can't be, like, I'm out trans out in the world and, you know, being, like, regular people competing and stuff. I can never do that, especially now with the laws. Like, seeing a doctor, I can't say I'm trans in certain states now. You have no right to impede on a person, an individual that you don't pay their bills for. It doesn't matter. It doesn't affect your life whether they're alive or dead. Their doctor is their doctor and not yours. I guarantee you, your legislator there does not have the same doctor as you. It's not his fucking business, even if they do. So I don't see why all this matters in the middle of a pandemic. We had the governor of Georgia, who's a piece of shit racist, who cheated Stacey Abrams, sat in her chair under the most racist fucking painting of a master house, the most prominent, horrible, and cruel master plantation house known in history, to keep black people from voting, to keep them from being able to be given water, to keep them from being able to, like, what is wrong with, oh yeah, you have to cheat to win. Still want to win though, because we'll find a way. We'll find a way. We always do. And people are resilient, even in prison, trust me. I've seen them do it. They'll find a way. And you can kiss my motherfucking ass. I will fucking get a drone and fly people water, bitch. I'll fly them a case and drop it to them. Seriously, what the fuck are you going to do about it? You can't arrest us all. And it's civil disobedience. Seriously, shut the fuck up. That girl, what's that hoe's name? Not the crazy, well, I mean, this bitch crazy, too. The one in Colorado that had the had the gun sitting behind her, and she wanted to fucking trap. She got owned. Oh, she owned herself, but she's a dumbass. Happy International Mermaid Day for everyone. I wish everyone a good day today. I will be working today by myself. It's going to be a good time. A good fucking time. So, officials under Trump not working anymore are revealing some very interesting information. They're like, they fought against death threats, mixed messages, and in some cases being kept from sharing information with national audiences. What? So in Trump's whorehouse, I mean white whorehouse, trash house. Yeah, white trash house. I can say that. I'm not on Facebook. In Trump's white trash whorehouse, the COVID war, speaking out at 8 p.m. on Friday on April 2nd on CNN. It will be also available on demand. But these six leading U.S. health officials are now going to be revealing to CNN the real challenges they faced during the nation's fight against COVID-19 over the past year, which did include death threats, mixed messages, and in some cases being kept from sharing information with national audiences. These nation doctors are Dr. Deborah Birx, Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. Brett, is that Gerard? Dr. Stephen Hahn, Dr. Robert Kedlick, and Dr. Robert Redfield. They're fighting a pandemic that would claim more than 500,000 American lives, all while navigating a White House fraught with strained relationships and very little mask wearing. These six doctors responsible for previous administration COVID-19 response reflect on the past year. They're responding with CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Now, he's interesting. Now, it's they're calling it the COVID war. Now, the reflections reveal a common theme. There was a contention behind closed doors, a lack of preparedness, just as there has been growing divisiveness in the United States during the pandemic. There was divisiveness among America's leadership. Now, they literally could see the avalanche coming from the beginning. They could see the public health threat ahead of them. But there were some Trump administration officials who believed this wasn't a big deal, as the doctors were making it seem. Now, Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House coronavirus response coordinator under President Trump, said that in late February, she had an initial goal. First, she wanted to make sure that they stopped saying that the risk was to Americans was low. She could see the avalanche coming. Well, of course, we all could. they were not prepared, and they wanted to do something. But the White House, there was a group that really believed this wasn't a big deal as they were making it, and there was another group that was just as fatalistic that no matter what we did, the outcome was going to be the same. What? Now, the division could be seen in some of the White House Coronavirus Task Force's public briefings, especially when it came to wearing masks. Sometimes the doctors were the only officials or among the very few seen with masks on. Now, there was a feeling in the White House from the beginning, and they didn't know if this was true or not because they never confronted the president because they didn't have access to him by that time. But the president was not supportive of mask wearing in the White House. There was not one event. Now, the Rose Garden, it was made clear that they didn't want us wearing masks. So all the cabinet officials and even some of the military members took their masks off. Dr. Fauci and Birx did not. Trump's parallel streams of data, the pandemic progressed, and there were too many parallel streams of data about the pandemic being presented. Trump, Birx also stressed to him that the concern about the U.S. economy seemed to outweigh concern about the hospitalizations and death. He was worried about money making people who, if you, they're sick, they can't work, you stupid fuck. That's why you can't have a businessman running a fucking country, because if you're like my boss, he'll ask you if you're going to come in when you're getting a COVID test. What? I have to quarantine. She came into work sick. Are you kidding? Trump presented graphs that Dr. Birx never made. They dealt with the presidents and prime ministers around the globe who will often have misperceptions about diseases in that community that the disease impacts. But they've always found that you can find common ground with the information and data. And they will change their policies. Part of the reason why they did say at one time the president looked at the data and understood the data because he wouldn't have shut down the country for 15 days and another 30, but that never really happened. Again, because there were too many parallel streams of data. Those parallel streams of data, you think the originator was Scott Atlas? Atlas, a neuroradiologist, was a highly controversial advisor to Trump on the coronavirus pandemic. Atlas resigned from the Trump administration in November. I know some of them came from his team, Birx said. I don't know where they all came from. Wow. Now CNN reached out to Atlas for a comment. But Dr. Birx vows she won't sit with Trump. Picked a task force member. So some of the misleading information coming from Atlas was enough for Birx to refuse to attend meetings with him. I've told people I would not be in a meeting with Dr. Atlas again, she said. I felt strongly that I didn't want any inaction that legitimized any way his position. That position, one that several experts have disputed, was support of allowing the virus to spread in the healthy populations in order to develop herd immunity. Here's the thing about herd immunity, which he called it herd mentality one time, which really it is when it comes to Trump cult. A lot of people either have to be vaccinated or a lot of people have to die. So you want people to die? I mean, the culling of Americans is what I'm calling it. I see it as this. The government sees it as a good way to clean up some of the extra bodies that take up some resources. We've depleted our resources three times over. When Utah is sharing water with Colorado, we have a problem. Let me tell you something, you guys. I lived in Colorado. They depend on the water from the mountains. The snowpack is so important. The more snow in the mountain caps in Colorado, the more water they can depend on that will come down, because that they rely on that. And they have to share water with other states, of course, but they're running low on water. So when you have a problem like this, I can tell you right now that, yeah, some people have got to die. And that, if you're looking at it as a perspective of business, a businessman would cut the fat. Sort of like cattle. If you have a bunch of cattle that you can't get rid of and a disease happens, you're going to let it kind of take over if you have too many and take out the wheat. So that's how I look at it. If you're someone who cares about your cattle and they get a disease, of course you're going to try and keep, you know, keep them alive no matter what. But if you're someone who has too many and they get sick, then it's 10-to-1. If you survive, great. Good. You can go back to work. Basically, that's how I'm seeing with the response. So as you can hear that these people were fighting and the fucking their own people that they were having to advise. So literally an approach would mean nationwide people would get sick in order to build up immunities and people would die in the process. And that's just what I told you without reading the article. And I just read that from the article. Now, day one, when he showed up, it was very clear. It was written in his view. Admiral Brett Rahr, who served as U.S. Health and Human Services Assistant Secretary under the former president, said the subtlety here was the thought that he could protect the vulnerable and sort of, well, build up his herd immunity. This is fallacy, literally. Now, the pandemic was a community-spreading event, and there was no way to ring-fence vulnerable Americans. It was reported that we had a shouting match. Yeah, at the same time, there was some tension between the doctors and Atlas. There was apparently contention between former Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar and the former heads of the nation's top public health agencies, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, it was reported in the press that we had a shouting match. Stephen Hahn, former FDA commissioner, told Gupta, and that's 100% assure you that they did not shout and scream at the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Gupta asked if he shouted at them. You should ask him that question. That's so funny. So you can catch that interview on CNN on April 2nd. And that just gives you a little taste of the kind of shit that our own health officials had to go through. I mean, seriously, this is like when Christina Aguilera found out she had a singing talent, did the talent show in her town at her school, and her family had to move away and go to another school because they were receiving death threats. This is just sad. But these are the same people who came from... Sorry. These are the same people whose ancestors were the ones who were angry that their school got integrated and they had to share a fucking fountain with some black dudes. So, you know, sounds about white. So anyhow, moving on. We got 25 minutes. All right. What happened here? Yeah, there we go. Thank you. All right. So, anywho, I know that I saved some trees. So I've got a little thing for you guys, and if you want to try and understand your country right now, and things really, really boggle you, you might want to take a look at drained swimming pool politics. Drained pool politics, you ask? Well, A drained swimming pool shows how racism harms white people, too. So if you're a white person who thinks racism only hurts people of color, the story behind an empty abandoned swimming pool in Missouri might just change your mind. The Fairground Park Pool in St. Louis was the largest public pool in the U.S. when it was built in 1919. It featured sand from a beach, a fancy diving board, and enough room for up to 10,000 swimmers. It was dug during a pool building boom when cities and towns competed to provide their citizens with public amenities that promoted civic pride and symbolized a perk of the American dream. These public pools, of course, were for whites only, but when civil rights leaders successfully pushed for them to be integrated, many cities either sold the pools to private entities or, in the case of Fairground Park, eventually drained them and closed them down for good. Those closures didn't just hurt black people, though. They also denied the pleasures of the pool to white people. Isn't that funny? Now, Heather McGee tells the story of the Fairground Park Pool in her powerful new book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Now, McGee employs the metaphor of a drained, cracked public pool to make a larger point. White refusal to share resources available to U.S. citizens doesn't just hurt people of color. It damages the families and their future, too. McGee has a name for this pain. She called it drain pool politics. If you want to know why the U.S. has one of the most inefficient healthcare systems among advanced nations, some of the worst infrastructure, and a dysfunctional political system, blame drain pool politics. Politics are built on a lie that many white Americans have bought for centuries. When black or brown people gain something, white people lose. The narrative that white people should see the well-being of people of color as a threat to their own is one of the most powerful subterranean stories in America. McGee writes in her book, until we destroy the idea, opponents of progress can only unearth it and use it to block any collective action that benefits us all. Now, Heather McGee's book debuted last week at number 3 on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list and is already so popular that her publisher is scrambling to keep up with demand. It comes less than a year after the George Floyd protests sparked a national racial reckoning. But McGee's book doesn't just make the familiar white people are voting against their economic interest arguments that many of us have heard before. She fills it with personal stories from her life and the people she encountered during 3 years of visiting churches, union halls, and small towns across America. McGee's book may soon be regarded as a classic in race literature, and the phrase drained pool politics could join white fragility in the lexicon people invoke when talking about race. McGee, a former president of Demos, a progressive think tank, recently spoke to CNN about her new book and this moment in America's racial history. Our conversation was edited for clarity and length. How would you explain to, say, a white Trump voter motivated by racial resentment that racism has harmed him? Excellent question. Supporters of President Donald Trump in Bristol, Pennsylvania, on October 24, 2020, when you think about Make America Great, that time period was a time when a white guy could walk into a factory and walk out set for life. When college was paid for the government, when a great middle class house was subsidized by the government, when the minimum wage was high, when taxes were high. That formula is a formula that you reject now when given the political choice between a strong middle class and the party that markets to your race, but delivers economic benefits only to the wealthy. You cite the 2008 housing market crash as a fire that started in black and brown communities, but eventually spread to white communities as well. can you cite another example of something that was seen as a problem largely confined to Black people that ended up costing white people too? The pandemic itself is an example of a virus that hit the Black and Brown and Indigenous communities first and worst. And then the illusion that it was only happening to blue cities and brown people allowed the Trump administration to take its eye off the ball and downplay the risk and turn it into a culture war and the us versus them, where the COVID support shouldn't go to blue states, which was also signifying brown people. That is an example of the fires raging in Black and Brown and Indigenous communities, that were disproportionately exposed because of systemic racism. And then 9 months later, the highest rates are in heavily white places like South and North Dakota and West Virginia. And then you realize that our fates are linked. As you explained, white support for government programs that built up the white middle class eventually fell as the civil rights movement blossomed because of a zero-sum approach to politics. Whatever helps Black people must hurt whites. When President Reagan said it in his first inaugural address that government was the problem, was he invoking the zero-sum perspective that you talk about? President Ronald Reagan famously said in 1981, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem, agreed. He was. What had government done wrong? When you think about the picture that Ronald Reagan was trying to paint of government mismanagement and government's poor judgment, you'd already have a decade of war on poverty, which was an extension of public benefits across the color line. From it being up until 1960s, largely for white people, and so there was an image in the white American mind of what business government had gotten into that they shouldn't have been in and that they didn't do well. There was a radicalized story, and the term public had already become degraded and associated with people of color, public housing, and public schools that had already become integrated. You think about the ways in which government provided for the common good during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s in a way that built the white middle class. The book includes a section where it lists all of the free stuff that government gave to white families to help them intergenerational wealth and economic security. And now once we began to desegregate, government became stingier, and that impacted everybody. You said in the book that refilling the pool requires us to believe in government again. How important, then, is the pending COVID relief bill and new voting rights bill just passed by the White House, in getting people to believe in government again? Now, there are some success stories in the country's pandemic response and in places where the vaccine is being delivered well. Not here. My mom hasn't found her second one, and she's going to be screwed. In New York, for example, I got my first vaccine shot, and it was Air Force personnel who were delivering the shots, and it was FEMA that had set up the site, and it was on the grounds of a public community college. That is a beautiful thing, seeing our government do its job to help people who absolutely couldn't help themselves. And that's the kind of sight that we need to see more of, and that we can restore our faith in the possibility of what we can do together. The exact counter to that is in Texas, the state cut off from the federal government to avoid being regulated, to avoid the kinds of safeguards that would have stopped the power outages, a state government that was totally absent from prevention to mitigation and taking care of its people. That was a very clear example of drained pool politics, of anti-government sentiment being put into policies that hurt everyone. It costs lives. You praise the Fight for $15 campaign to raise the minimum wage. What did the campaign do right to avoid the zero-sum politics, to avoid people using race to divide white, black, and brown workers? Now, protesters attend a rally for a $15 hour minimum wage on Friday. This was February 16th. This happened in Orlando this year. Now, they talked about it. they explicitly made the idea of racism as a divide and conquer tool, a part of worker education, a part of the rhetoric, a part of the protest signs. Now, the zero sum is so pervasive in our politics as it's sort of the right-wing messaging in that in order to counter it, you have to engage with it head-on. You have to call it out, give people a way to recognize it, and reject it. Now, I've heard many political scientists say, though, that the way you sell policy that helps black or brown people is to make it a race neutral. They say, for example, when Obamacare was something pushed for by a black president for people of color, it wasn't popular. But now that is seen as a program that benefits white people, and it's more popular. It benefits me. I'm not a black person. Let's be very clear. Obama didn't talk about it in terms of race. No, he did not. Now, this is the point. Policies, you can't avoid race. Race is the central character in the drama about government and our economy. And if you don't acknowledge that and give voters another way of thinking about race, then you're just missing a huge part of the story. Now, you write that diversity is country's superpower. What do you mean? Demonstrators are protesting. They've been protesting George Floyd since May 31st, 2020, and I believe maybe even a little before. Now, St. Paul, Minnesota, that was a pretty big deal. And it goes on. We had them here, and they're breaking people's windows. Oh, please don't. And Orlando is actually giving out gifts because they're hurting people. They want people to like them again. So the research does show that the diversity allows groups to think better about critical problems. Now, it is the friction of coming from different backgrounds and looking at issues from different vantage points that create a productive energy, and we are one of the most diverse nations. There is someone here with a tie to every community on the globe, and we could use that to our competitive advantage, and the us versus them zero-sum quality that we have is holding back our potential. Agreed. Especially when it comes to women. If we were smart, we would just take out the men by getting together and taking over. But you know, hey, I don't know. So did writing this book and traveling across the U.S. to meet people make you more optimistic or pessimistic about the country's future? Oh, this is a good question. I left my travels much more optimistic because I saw those signs of solidarity, dividends in nearly everywhere I visited, and pockets of America where people are crossing lines, lines of race, and unlocking that diversity superpower and rejecting the zero sum. Now, that is really exciting to me. We're at a moment of awakening in this country where more and more white folks are feeling that they have to relearn and unlearn some of what they learned, and that there's a sense of wanting to change our course, recognizing that we have gone off course as a country and that we have to face up to decisions in order to really have the country that we deserve. I find that this is going to be a great book to read. I find it intriguing and I feel a little bit more optimistic just hearing about her travels and discovering all of this. So drain pool politics. This is something that I definitely can relate to. I definitely feel that. So Heather McGee, check out her book. That's The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. You know, reading is great, and it's good for the soul. So I want to something. I want to read a story. And I'm reading this to you because somebody could have said something. This is the short and sad life of Christian Choate. This is an article by Emily Thompson. It's from December 2018. May of 2011, police in Gary, Indiana received a tip from a woman who told them where they could find the body of a child who had been killed 2 years prior. They were directed to a mobile home park in the 5900 block of West 36th Avenue, where they made a distressing discovery. Buried underneath a layer of concrete in a shed was the body of a 13-year-old Christian Choate. He had been murdered by his father, Riley Choate, and his stepmother, Kimberly Cubina. I will fucking kill you, you piece of shit. 2009, Christian's sister, Christina Choate, had mustered up the courage to confess what she knew about Christian's death to her mother, who then called the police. The discovery of Christian's body revealed an ugly history of child abuse and neglect. In 2004, Christian's mother, Amy Eric Estrada, lost custody of him and Christina after her live-in boyfriend was accused of molesting him. Christina told authorities that his mother had also touched him inappropriately, and Christian and Christina then moved in with their father. Riley Choate and his wife, Kimberly Cubina, and several cousins and step-siblings, despite the fact that in August of that year, Choate had also been accused of abusing his son. Investigators could not substantiate the abuse allegations, but DCS officials did determine that Choate had physically abused Cubina's nieces, who were living with him at the time. Inappropriate discipline, bruising on the two girls, and as a result of the abuse, the nieces were removed from the home, so why wasn't he, and why wasn't she? They were placed in foster care for months.
Hold on.
He wrote letters of detailing abuse and mistreatment. You know, he was mistreated and he wanted to die. I believe they kept him in a fucking cage. His short life was marked by allegation of family members physically and sexually abusing him and other underage relatives. Why did you not take him away and all the kids? This is where the system fails children. The officials investigated 8 allegations of physical and sexual abuse, molestation, and educational and medical neglect in various homes that the Choate family members lived in before his death. What in the fuck? Riley Choate was accused of abusing Christian in August 2004, a year before Riley Choate was given custody. How is it? Substantiate the fucking allegations now? As a result, Kimberly Cubina's Choate's nieces were placed in foster care for more than 3 months. They returned to Choate's home in 2004. August 2005, Lake Juvenile Court officials also granted Riley Choate custody of Christian and Christina. Children had been with Amy Eric Estrada. Eric Estrada lost custody of Christian and Christina amid accusations that either she or her live-in boyfriend were molesting them, so they couldn't substantiate, or did they? So they substantiated neglect and lack of supervision. They substantiated abuse against her live-in boyfriend, but he was never criminally charged. The Times is not naming him because he was not charged. It is unclear from DCS records why Riley Choate, a convicted felon and known abuser, was given custody of Christian and Christina instead of placing the children in another relative or in foster care. I don't know. Neglect? What the fuck? Lake Juvenile Court Judge Mary Beth Bonaventura could not be reached on Friday afternoon for comment. Of course, she's probably white. The DCS records show her court granted Riley Choate custody. I'm not racist. I just call it as I see it. The Eric Estrada was allowed supervised visits with the children. DCS spokeswoman, I'm sorry, if you could substantiate abuse, why are they visiting the children? And why are they with the convicted felon? What the fuck is wrong with this country? Woman Ann Houseworth said the state agency does not get involved in custody battles but could be called to offer recommendations. She could not say whether DCS investigators were asked to offer recommendations in this case. Allegations of misdeeds by Riley Choate and Kimberly Cubina Choate continued after the couple secured custody
of both children. Cries for help in 2007. DCF officials were called to Choate's home to investigate claims that there were 10 children living with them in that home was dirty. Investigators cited one adult, a relative of Trevina Choate, for medical neglect, but did not substantiate any other allegations. What in the fuck? Why are they still in the house? 2008, they met with the family again, and it was in the Living Mobile Home Park in Gary. They were asked to investigate allegations that at least 10 children were living in the home, and one who was under the under what the family called house arrest for molesting another child. Allegations, what the fuck? So after Christian's body was discovered in May, family members told investigators Christian had molested one of his younger relatives. None of the family members reported the allegations while Christian was alive. March 2008, Christian told his pediatrician he was getting locked up at night. Medical records show the doctor never reported it. Really? The doctor declined comment Friday when contacted at home. The doctor no longer works at the Highland Medical Practice. Good. Where medical records indicate Christian was a patient. The last contact DCS officials had with Christian was in 2008 and the summer before he is believed to have died. Investigators could not substantiate the allegations made against the family. Oh, my God. Letters Christian wrote while locked in the cage detailed the mistreatment. In his own words, paint a disturbing picture of what the boy's life was. Very sad. And it's a best show. He wondered if anyone was going to help him. Are you fucking kidding? He wondered if they were going to give him food or liquid. Court documents allege that he was beaten several years and kept in a cage for as long as a year before his death in early 2009. His disappearance wasn't reported until May. In documents released Friday, Christian wrote how often he missed food or used the bathroom in his place of confinement. He was led out to clean or had to go back inside immediately. He wrote about other children playing outside while he was confined. He asked for something to do. He was given paper and pencil. Some of his things were random while others appeared to be assignments from his stepmother. I would fucking kill the Kobina Choate wrote topics on top of some of the pages, including, why do you want to play with your peers? Why do you still want to see your mom? Why can't you let the past go? What does it mean to be a part of a family? Why the fuck would you do this to someone? Analyzing the system, state and local investigators are now trying to determine how the system failed. If and how, because you fucking did. Spokeswoman Ann Houseworth said the state agency followed all Indian laws and DCS policies and procedures and investigation. Many allegations. They did everything it legally could. You mean everything didn't do? That doctor should be put in jail. Why is it that this happened? Not going to happen to my kid. It shouldn't happen to any child. Just like kids in cages shouldn't. That's a tea, y'all. That's a tea, y'all. I had enough today. Wear your mask. Wash your hands. It's better. It's in business. Do something. Don't sit behind your keyboard and angry. I'll be back on tomorrow. I'll see you Wednesday. Learn something today. Bye.